In one of her most striking Christological statements, Ellen G. White says not only that it was Jesus who gave Moses the law on Mount Sinai, but also that it was he and not the Father who manifested God's presence throughout the Old Testament times. In an appendix note, the editors tried to justify this statement with considerations taken mainly from 1 Corinthians 8:6, Acts 7:38, John 1:1-3, and 1 Peter 1:10-11. The purpose of this paper is to argue that John 1:14-18 offers a more relevant and effective basis for the claim that it was the pre-existent Christ who appeared to Moses at Sinai, and the one through whom God has always revealed himself to humanity. Other concerns related to this passage, no matter how important they might be, or to the divinity of Jesus, including other lines of evidence of his possible identification with Yahweh, will not be dealt with here. I will skip the parts in gray and read only the parts in black, okay? John 1:14-18, the third part of the Gospel's prologue, is a passage of its own. Though the term logos clearly sets these verses in continuity to the previous ones, its sudden reappearance, as well as the introduction of the first person plural, the more distinct theological tone of the argument and its climactic effect seems to justify an independent treatment. Another change in relation to the preceding verses, especially verses 1 through 5, has to do with the conceptual background. While in the introduction of his account of the Logos, John resorts to the creation story of Genesis 1 to emphasize his divine preexistence with God and creative power, he now appeals to the Exodus tradition to bring the Logos from the cosmic sphere and place him firmly within the realm of Israel's history. The result is a radical claim. Since there is no question about the identity of the Logos, what John seems to argue in these verses is that Jesus Christ is the incarnation of the Old Testament God, the God of Israel. And two are the motives used by the evangelist to express such a concept: the Levitical tabernacle as the medium of God's presence among his people, and the giving of the law at Sinai, particularly the second giving following the episode of the golden calf. With regard to the tabernacle imagery, which is used in verse 14, A through C, to convey the very notion of the incarnation, the idea is obtained from the combination of two words, skeno, to dwell, and doxa, glory. The former, which appears only here in the Gospel, recalls the language that the Old Testament, in both its Hebrew and Greek forms, uses for the tabernacle in the wilderness, the portable prototype of the temple and the ancient dwelling place of God in Israel. The latter, doxa, certainly refers here to the glorious manifestation of God's presence in the tabernacle. As for the giving of the law, there are at least four points of convergence between John 1:14-18 and that story. First, the contrast between Moses and Jesus in verse 17 explicitly refers to the giving of the law at Sinai. Second, the statement, "We have seen his glory," while pointing to God's hidden glory in the tabernacle, also brings to mind Moses' request to see God's glory in Exodus 34:18. Third, John's assertion that no one has ever seen God echoes God's response to Moses, "You cannot see my face, for no one shall see my face and live." And fourth, the expression "full of grace and truth" is a deliberate allusion to Rav Chesed Va'emet of Exodus 34:6. The reading of John's prologue against the Old Testament conceptual background is largely consensual today. In his careful scientific analysis of all the proposed parallels, from Gnostic to Hermetic literature, from the Old Testament and from the Jewish interpretive tradition, to determine the cultural context of the prologue to the fourth gospel, Craig Evans concludes that this should be found entirely within the Jewish synagogal domain. Its specific antecedents, he says, are the biblical texts relating to creation and the Sinai covenant, interpreted against the Old Testament myth of wisdom and ideas of God's dwelling in Israel. Let's move now to page 9. Let's move now to the passage itself. Any adequate interpretation of John 1, 14 through 18 must address the issue of the invisibility of God, which is emphasized in verse 18a. No one has ever seen God. Elsewhere in the Gospel, as well as in his first epistle, John repeats the same idea, which is also found in Paul. Interpreters in general usually take this statement in connection with the Old Testament period. They point to the fact that it was a given within Judaism of John's time that no human could see God with his or her bodily eyes except in the age to come, and convinced that there is here an allusion to Moses' experience at Sinai, they try to diminish the significance of that experience by insisting on God's words to him, "You cannot see my face, for no one shall see me and live." As for the theophany itself, the most that is conceded is that what Moses saw was only a sort of afterglow of the divine glory. Then, the next step is to interpret the following statement, verse 18b, "The only Son, he has made him known," with reference to the revelation brought by the incarnate Christ. In other words, according to the standard interpretation, there is in John 1:18 a contrast between two different periods of history, the Old Testament times and the time of Jesus. However, though it appears that Moses did not see the face of God, it could be said that to all intents and purposes, he saw God when God passed before him, something that is confirmed in the New Testament. In addition, there are at least five other accounts in the Old Testament of people seeing God. Isaiah literally says, "I saw the Lord." So do Manoah and his wife, and the prophet Micaiah. Jacob certainly saw him at Peniel, and Abraham at Mamre. But there might have been others. Next page. It is important to note, however, that for John, it is not only God himself, but also God's form that has never been seen. Not even God's voice has ever been heard. The question is, how does John reconcile his emphasis on the invisibility or hideness of God with the Exodus narrative wherein Moses does see God? As Gizzi correctly acknowledges, there is a contradiction here. Gizzi then tries to explain this contradiction by also playing down the revelation to Moses and saying that the revelation was limited to God's passing by and to seeing his back, in the sense that it was necessarily hidden by a covering which separates humans from what is transcendent. This, however, seems to imply a denial of the Old Testament tradition on John's part. It has been suggested that verse 18, in fact, consists in a polemical rejection of the Jewish claims about Moses. But two points must be kept in mind. Though the context makes it clear that the primary reference of verse 18a is the Sinai theophany, John's construction, "no one ever, udes popote," clearly requires a more general application. And second, John's polemic is against contemporary Judaism, not against Moses or the biblical tradition. It is possible that John's descent-ascent motif throughout the Gospel is designed to contradict the claims of Jewish speculative mysticism that Moses ascended into heaven, but that Moses, as well as Abraham, Jacob, Isaiah, and several others, saw God is well established in Scripture itself. And Scripture was an important ally to John in his dispute with his fellow Jews. In the fourth gospel, all references to Scripture are positive. Even Moses, when correctly understood, testifies on behalf of Jesus. The solution to the difficulty suggested by the statement that no one has ever seen God is rather simple, though far-reaching in its implications. Since there is no question that theos in John 1:18a refers to God the Father, as in the following clause, it is explicitly equated with pater, John's point is that on those occasions in Israel's history when God is described as being seen, and I would add as being heard, it was not actually God the Father who was seen, but Jesus Christ. He says, "The only Son who is in the bosom of the Father, he has made him known. For the evangelist, therefore, Jesus Christ, the only one to come from God and to have seen God, is the revelation of God, God made visible. He is not only the agent of creation, but also the agent of revelation, or of interpretation, as John actually says in verse 18b, where he uses the verb exegeomai, which means to interpret. As Larson declares, all knowledge of God outside the revelation in the Logos, both pre-incarnate and incarnate, seems to be denied. The only difference between the Old Testament revelations and the incarnation, says Riederbos, is that the former were temporary and restricted to a few people. The fourth gospel itself provides explicit evidence for this claim. Referring to Isaiah's vision of God in the temple, John plainly says that the glory the prophet saw was Jesus, not God's. Similarly, Jesus' enigmatic statement that Abraham saw his day, whatever its precise meaning, makes it clear that Jesus, not God, was the object of Abraham's vision. In their respective contexts, both statements make Isaiah and Abraham witnesses to Jesus against the Jews by making Jesus the object of the visions, thus confirming the claim that Jesus is and has always been the only authoritative revelation of God. That is to say, apart from Jesus Christ, there has never been any personal revelation of God. Page 14. With the previous discussion in mind, the distinction in verse 17 between the law given through Moses and grace and truth occurring through Jesus seems now clear. In this verse, John does not mean that the Sinai event has become obsolete, being entirely superseded by the incarnation event. The traditional interpretation of this verse has been greatly impacted by the tension between law and grace in the writings of Paul, but unfortunately, as that tension was understood by Marcion. The Marcionite influence is still present on those interpretations that assume a complete break between law and grace, as if they originally represented two different systems which were intrinsically opposed to each other and impossible to be reconciled, so that the law needed to be replaced by grace. A less radical approach seeks to establish some sort of continuity between the law of the Old Testament and the grace of the New Testament. But as a rule, this also ends with the exaltation of grace at the expense of the law. Frank Thielman, for example, argues that the Mosaic law was characterized by grace, but its measure of grace pales in comparison with what has become available with the appearance of Jesus Christ. There is no question, however, that John's words should be understood in light of the Exodus 34:6, and none of the interpretations above does justice to the context of that passage. After the episode of the golden calf and the breaking of the tablets of the law by Moses, God asked him to cut new tablets of stone so that he could write on the tablets the words that were on the former tablets. Moses did so. Then he went up Mount Sinai, where God had promised to pass before him. When that happened, God himself proclaimed among his attributes that he is Rav Hesed Va'emet, abounding in steadfast love and truth. This is exactly what John says about the incarnate Logos in John 14, verse 14e, full of grace and truth, whose idea is picked up again in verse 16 and brought to its logic conclusion in verse 17. Verse 15 is clearly parenthetical. In other words, on the basis of the Sinai episode, and contrary to what Thielman says, it is not the law proper that was characterized by grace, but God, who described himself as a God of grace and truth. In verse 17, therefore, the evangelist is only reporting what happened at Sinai. He is only being faithful to the Exodus narrative, wherein the giving of the law through Moses is clearly distinguished from the revelation of God's grace and truth by God himself. John is not contrasting a graceless law with the grace that is available in Jesus. It is important to keep the text as it is, without reading into it an adversative but that is not there. Likewise, it is important to note that in Exodus 34:6 and 7, there is no single indication that God's Hesed va'emet to Israel were only partial and thus inferior to his charis kai aletheia in the incarnation. As already mentioned, verse 17 is not but the logic conclusion of the argument which starts in verse 14e, where grace and truth is first applied to Jesus. But more than being how God revealed himself to Moses at Sinai, grace and truth is how the Old Testament consistently refers to God's covenantal faithfulness. The implication is that by applying the same expression to Jesus, John wants to make a further Christological claim that God's covenantal promise has now been fulfilled in a way that far exceeds that of the Exodus. Page 18. In Exodus 34:6, the meaning of Hesed va'emet must be seen in the context of the covenant and against the episode of the golden calf. According to the book of Exodus, God announces his intent to fulfill the promise of a covenantal relationship between himself and his people. Then he delivers Israel from Egypt and discloses to her the laws that would regulate that relationship. When the people pledge to obey him and the covenant is ratified, God sets forth the plans for the construction of the sanctuary so that the covenantal promise could become a reality. Before the implementation of those plans, however, the Israelites are involved in a frightful act of disobedience, the result of which is a real possibility that God will annul the covenant and destroy them. After Moses' intercession, God's abundant grace moves him to forgive the people and to maintain his covenant. Granting Moses' request to see his glory as a sign of his favor towards the people, God reveals himself, his name, and his character, and states among his attributes that he is Rav Hesed va'emet, abounding in steadfast love and truth. That was a particularly solemn revelation coming from the mouth of God himself in the course of the Theophany and highlighting divine mercy and covenantal faithfulness. In the sequence, the tabernacle is built and God's promise to dwell among his people is finally fulfilled. Thus, by saying that the Logos was full of grace and truth, John may want to call attention to God's covenantal faithfulness, loyalty, and commitment. It is important to note that the emphasis in verses 17 through 18 falls exactly on charis, since charis alone is resumed in verse 16. What Evangelist appears to argue is that the incarnation was a sort of antitypical fulfillment of God's covenantal dwelling among his people. And so, an act of grace and faithfulness on God's part. This is why he can claim that those who believed in Jesus, including himself, have received from that grace, from the fullness of that grace. As the Sinai covenant, after being broken, was renewed and had its promise eventually fulfilled because of God's faithfulness, so the covenantal relationship brought about by the incarnation owed its fulfillment to the same faithfulness of God as it was manifested through his Son, Jesus Christ. This is why John can refer to the incarnation as grace instead of anti-grace. John does not mean that the grace of Christ has been received instead of the grace of the law, or that the grace of Christ was superior to the grace of the law, or even that the grace of Christ succeeded the grace of the law. The law has no grace in itself. In the New Testament, the law is never referred to as or containing charis. What John means is only that the grace of Sinai has been replaced by the grace of the incarnation. The issue of continuity, discontinuity between law and grace is not raised here. Neither is there any hint of a grace available in two degrees, Old and New Testaments. When verse 16 is read in connection with verses 14e and 17, however, there seems to be a hint of a covenant being replaced by another, in that the symbol meets its reality and the promise its fulfillment. Only in this sense is one superior to the other, for both were covenants of grace, of the same grace, which in both instances was abundantly revealed by Jesus Christ himself. Conclusion. In John 1, 14 through 18, John 1, 14 through 18, therefore, represents what can be described as the highest point of the New Testament Christology, namely, the identification of Jesus Christ as Yahweh, the God of Israel. This is not, of course, the only passage that affords such an identification, not even in John's prologue, which at the very start locates the Logos with God in the Enarche, in the beginning of Genesis 1, and makes him the creator through whom all things were made. It is also possible that in verses 9 and 10, rather than referring to the incarnation, John has in mind the presence in the world of the pre-incarnate Christ and his several appearances during the Old Testament times. As far as the rest of the gospel is concerned, chances are that at least 1:45 and 5:46 should also be read likewise, that is, as referring to the real presence of Jesus in the Old Testament, and not as if Jesus was the object of prophecy, as they are usually understood. In addition, there is also the absolute ego eimi of 858, which in the Septuagint became the equivalent of a divine name, and in Johannine usage seems to point to Jesus' self-identification with Yahweh. Whatever the precise facts in relation to these texts, however, there should be no question that when read against the background of the Exodus tradition, verses 14 through 18 of the prologue gives full support to Mrs. White's claim that God has always revealed himself through Jesus, and so that it was Jesus who gave the law to Moses at Sinai. John's point seems clear. As it happened at Sinai, so it did now. As Jesus appeared to Moses and dwelt among his people, so he did now. But with the astounding difference that this now has been accomplished by means of his being made human flesh, causing his glory to become visible to all. But the argument may carry a deeper theological insight. By comparing the incarnation to God's dwelling among Israel in the past, John might want to say that Jesus brought the Sinai covenant, which apparently was intended to be temporary in the sort of shadow of the new era of salvation, to its perfect fulfillment. Thus, to those who accepted him and believed in his name, the new covenant took place of the old one, so that these believers could enter into a new dimension of relationship with God and say with confidence, from his fullness, we have all received. Thank you.